And good morning, KBOO listeners. You are listening to Positively Revolting with guest hosts Layla Kanan and myself, Jenka Soderberg. On today's show, we will be interviewing Dr. Yasser Abu-Jameh, psychiatrist and director of the Community Mental Health Program in Gaza. Later in the hour, we will be joined by Jihad Abu Salim, also from Gaza, who is now the Palestine-Israel Program Associate at the American Friends Service Committee in Chicago.
And due to recent events, we thought it would be relevant to interview two Palestinians from Gaza who can provide some important insights into the situation in Gaza. We will be taking your calls later in the hour, so stay tuned and get your comments and questions ready. Dr. Yasser, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
So the Gaza Strip, just for listeners, some background, is one of the two occupied Palestinian territories that have been occupied by the Israeli military since 1967. It is located between Israel and Egypt on the Mediterranean coast, but Israeli military forces control air, sea, and land through a blockade, and have held it under a strict blockade since 2007 after the election of the Hamas party.
Yes. And three major Israeli invasions of Gaza have taken place in the past 10 years alone. Operation Cast Lead in 2008-9, when 1,400 Palestinians were killed. In 2012, Operation Pillar of Defense, in which Israeli forces killed more than 150 Palestinians and wounded 1,000 in just 8 days. And in 2014, Operation Protective Edge, which lasted for about a month and a half. More than 2,200 Palestinians were killed and over 11,000 were wounded. It's really hard to understand the sheer force that Israel uses in these attacks. According to the Institute for Middle East Understanding, Israel carried out more than 6,000 airstrikes in Gaza, which is an area about the size of Detroit and one of the most densely populated places on Earth.
So, Dr. Yasser, what can you begin just by telling us about the kind of trauma that your patients are experiencing in the Gaza Strip and how this affects their mental health?
Thank you very much. You know, the concept of trauma, it's about a sudden unexpected event that contains some threatening to the life of someone's or someone around him, whether this or could end just with death or with serious injury. Trauma is something that happens abrupt and then it ends, and then support comes in, and then people start to recover from whatever traumatic event they have. Most of the people recover without intervention, with some little support, but others need some mental health intervention, some specialized care, you know. Now, for Gaza, as you have already mentioned, we speak about an area that is under occupation for decades since 1967. We speak about 70% of populations who are refugees. We speak about 12 years of a blockade and three large-scale military operations that took place that any 14-year-old child will still remember. We are not talking about post-traumatic conditions in Gaza. We are talking about some ongoing traumatic events that keep traumatizing and re-traumatizing the people. This is on one hand. On the other hand, the issue about post, that really support comes in and that things normalize and people return to normal life is something that we miss in Gaza. Because, for example, neither after 2009 or 2012 or even 2014, life returned to normal in Gaza because the occupation is still in there, because the living conditions are extremely difficult due to the blockade. So we speak about affecting the life of people in two manners. One is the trauma itself, and the second thing is the implications of the living conditions that could lead to more like frustration, more like depression. So we have a very serious combination of anxiety-related problems. And on top of them is PTSD, and we have also problems in relation to the loss, which on top of them lies depression.
And what sort of coping mechanisms do you find are the most helpful for people who have this ongoing traumatic stress disorder, that there's never really a break in the trauma?
Well, I think we speak about different coping mechanisms. On top of them is a strong social network that we have in Palestine. You know, people are strongly connected. We speak about extended family support. We speak about the understanding of the whole community, that we are for the sake of good, you know, we are struggling to get our freedom, we are struggling to end the occupation, and that this usually comes at a cost, and people are going through difficult days but hoping for the better, wishing that at the end the occupation will end and they will just live in a dignified way.
And the people of Gaza, they live under what for most Americans is really unimaginable conditions. And yet the rate of suicide is significantly lower in Gaza than it is in the U.S. Can you explain this? How do you account for this?
Well, you know, we have, it's a big part of it is culturally related. One of the things is that a very strong religious opinion against suicide, which really makes it a big, a very hard decision to make if someone wants to commit suicide. The other thing is the presence of the very strong social network around people. And usually when you go through hard times, when you feel that people are still around you, when you see that also other people around you are going through the same and they are struggling, but they are going with their lives, with what they have, it becomes a really hard decision to end one's life. Mm.
And the siege has gone on for 11 years now, since 2007, which means children born during that time only know life under a blockade. So what kind of mental health issues arise from that that you're seeing among young children?
Well, among young children, we have three community mental health centers in Gaza Strip. One is in Gaza City, covering Gaza and the north. One is in Deir al-Balah, covering the middle areas. And the third one is in Khan Yunis, covering the south. Speaking of children who come to the three community centers, we speak about mostly trauma-related disorders. 50 to 60% of the children who arrive at our community centers suffer either from post-traumatic stress disorder or it's like connected problems, or from bedwetting, or what we call it, nocturnal enuresis. Both are symptoms of the feeling of insecurity and safety, the ongoing loud voices of bombardment that take place every now and then, those cues that remind people of war. Children are reminded, you know, at least twice per month through the presence of, you know, bombardment here and there, or presence of the drones in the skies. So there are many things that remind people of 2014, for example, attacks. And at the same time, we don't see protective mechanisms that are on the ground. We don't have, for example, shelters. We don't have anything. So whenever there is a strike or expected escalation, everyone could be a target. One international report spoke that in 2014, more than 75% of the population, of the people, sorry, who got killed, they were just killed in the wrong place, which means they were just at home and bombed, or they were just in the streets, totally, completely civilians. So with that lack of ability to really understand if you are safe or if you are not safe, or even to have any idea about what could be expected, this is really hard. And we say that in Gaza, the difference between, you know, that you continue to live tomorrow or you just die not knowing when and how is a very small difference. There is no line, you know, which is something really big. In any other place, you know, for, in order for someone to die, there should be something big that is happening, you know. But in Gaza, you never know. You never know if you are going to wake up tomorrow, for example, when there is a serious operation like what happened in 2014 or 8 or 9.
I mean, the impacts on mental health must be just devastating. You know, we're talking about young children. Young kids tend to think of their parents as these all-powerful beings that protect them from any monsters in life. But kids in Gaza must realize early on that there are forces far more powerful than their parents, and their parents can't protect them. What's the impact of this realization for kids?
Well, you know, while we speak on the short term about clearly trauma-related disorders like PTSD, like night or sleep disturbances, like bedwetting, on the long term, we have two very important issues that we see in children. One is low school achievement because they start to suffer, their academic achievement starts to decrease because, you know, the mind is basically busy with the feeling of insecurity and safety. And the mind of a child is not that much developed to understand the difficulties as adults do. So the reaction is somehow could be a little bit different and needs some understanding. So one thing is low school achievement. The other thing could be violence among children, because children in the beginning start to become irritable, then they start to become hyperactive, and you know when a group of children together are irritable, hyperactive, they start to fight, and then you end up with having violence. So, and on the very long term, unfortunately, you see that the society sometimes getting more and more violent, and this is seen when we look at reports speaking about increased domestic violence in Gaza Strip. So we need basically to put an end to those reasons for living such a hard life in Gaza in order to be able to change the life in Gaza and change the presentations of those or the impact of the psychological impact of the living conditions in Gaza.
The fear must just be overwhelming for a young child and take over anything else that they're thinking.
Yeah, well, you know, children are, they grow, and this is part of what GCMHP tries to do all the time, which means to, when we come to a family in this dark conditions, we try to color their life. You know, we can try to speak to the children, understand them very well, make parents understand what issues the children have, and then work together with the child and with the family. We have play therapy rooms, we have art therapy rooms, children can play, can enjoy their time, and parents can learn how to make a child feel safe despite the difficulties, and even in hard conditions, how to make a child feel that okay, it's really bumping, but we are safe. You know, things are very relative in Gaza. It's very hard to prove yourself before even your children that you are in a safe place. So that's why it gets more and more difficult for parents to speak about safety and security. But awareness is a very key point. You know, how they react when the bombardment takes place is very important, because children learn and see the fear when they see it in the faces of their parents. And this is a very important thing to keep in mind. And of course, you know, when you hear large or large sounds of bus of bombing, of course everyone would get terrified, you know.
And you yourself experienced an incredibly horrific family tragedy in 2014 when Israel bombed Gaza. And in one of the bombings, you lost 28 family members. How are you able to push past your own trauma and experiences to work with and help other traumatized people?
You know, in 2014... Or when you have such large scale operations, there are two aspects of it. One is the ongoing fear, which is basically the fight, the loud explosions, the ability to get killed at any moment, and the very challenging way to keep your children away or protected from what happens around them. It's a very challenging issue. So this is one thing that on minute-to-minute base you are really you are under pressure and psychologically exhausted, etc., etc. But we add to that when the loss comes to your friends, or for example to your cousins, or for example to your family or extended family, This makes also another huge impact on the people. So you are struggling to be, you know, just living under those hard conditions, and then you are struck with the fact that big three extended families with three pregnant women and about 17 children. They were all got bumped. The four-story building just was flattened, you know, with all those people inside. It's really very big catastrophe. We lost all of those in one sudden bombardment. It was at sunset. It was Ramadan when people were just getting prepared to have breakfast, you know, at about 6 p.m. and suddenly we heard two large bombardment voices. And we really didn't think at all for a minute that people were still inside, you know. Sometimes Israel sends a warning, and this is really funny when you see a warning. They warn sometimes building through the drone bombardment, you know. So a drone could just fire two missiles or one missile at a building, so people will just disappear or leave that building, and then the jet fighters or the will just bomb the whole building. But in that occasion, and in some other occasions, it wasn't only my family, but there were different occasions in 2014 where they just immediately sent, they just flattened the houses. It was extreme difficult. First, you need to collect the bodies of the people, of the children, you know, and in order to make sure that you got everyone from under the rubble. You speak about a four-story building, suddenly it became just like, you know, piles of cement and concrete, and then you need to look into the killed people. You do that all the night, and then in the morning you have a very huge funeral for those. It was really a trauma, but you wake up, you try to do things in a very short time, you don't even have time to say goodbye to the beloved ones, you know, and because you are under threat. You cannot really do that. We didn't have a funeral for 3 days, you know, cultural funeral, or the cultural, what we call it, mourning, you know, for 3 days that we keep families come and show solidarity. This didn't happen. And this is not only for people who get killed through the war. It's what happens during those 51 days. My grandmother passed away for natural reasons. She was in her late 80s. We just, took her to the hospital and buried her in less than 30 minutes without even being able to stay at the cemetery for more than 10 minutes. You just do that and you just run away because you need to make sure that you find yourself in a safe place. So, and this is something that is really a big issue. We didn't have time to reprocess the traumatic event, you know. You didn't have time to mourn the losses. And then you have to live with that. So this is very frustrating. It doesn't allow usual recovery mechanisms that people and humans are adapted to. And this is one of the major challenges that people need to go on with their lives with. That's that big traumatic event happened to them without being able to go on with their life, just to close it in a good manner that all other people can do.
Mm. Wow. And for those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Yasser Abu-Jameh with the Gaza Mental Health Center. Their website, with more information on their work and how to support the important work that Dr. Yasser is doing in Gaza, is gazamentalhealth.org. We have just a few minutes left with Dr. Yasser, and then we will have another guest the second half of the hour. And Dr. Yasser, I remember during the 2014 war, there were so many horrible images coming out that we were seeing here. One of the most moving and disturbing to me was seeing, just after all of these images of dead bodies coming from the bombardment, was a picture of a group of first responders all sitting in a line against a wall in the hospital, just crying, and the look on their faces of just the horror that they had seen. How do you, as a mental health professional, support each other in this work that you're seeing just the most difficult and traumatic cases?
You know, secondary traumatization is part of the risk that all people who work in, like first aid workers, including civil defense, including police officers, including ambulance, medical first aid, psychological first aid people are exposed to. Now, the difference in Gaza is that you are not only exposed to secondary traumatization, but you are also exposed to primary traumatization, because the trauma can happen to yourself. You live under the hard conditions. You hear the bombardment. You see people who are wounded around you, etc., etc. This combination is a very serious one. What we do in GCMHP is that we try to offer care for caregivers. And this begins by extending help to our colleagues who work in the field of mental health. And also we try to do our best to extend that support to the people who work at first aid, whether those are emergency workers at hospitals or in ambulances, or whoever is in need for that. But it's a very hard thing to do, you know, to be able to offer containment and contain other feelings when you yourself is under or exposed to the same difficult conditions.
And do you find the work that you do therapeutic for yourself, just as a wrap-up?
It's rewarding, you know. It's rewarding when you are able to change the life of a child. A child whose school achievements start to get lower and lower, and perhaps that child will not have a good future, because education is something very important for us in Palestine. So when you make a change to the child's future, making that child happy again, making her or him become engaged again, then that's a success story. And with each treated client or patient, with each survivor, there is a successful story. It's very difficult, but it's very rewarding. Hard work, but we try to end our day with success stories.
I just wanted to ask Dr. Yasser before you have to leave. I know you're getting on the road to go to Olympia today, and but we have a couple more minutes with you. The U.S. recently cut off support to the UN Relief and Works Agency, which is the main support organization for Palestinian refugees. What's been the impact of those cuts on your work?
Now, unfortunately, part of that fund cutting touched the school counselors who work at UNRWA schools. All those stuff, I think more than 300 people are now on part-time jobs, which means that the accessibility of children to have counseling have decreased to 50%, which means that children are less entitled to receive counseling at schools. And on the other hand, means that we will have more cases that will be referred to our community centers. I hope that this decision will be reversed, and that for the year 2019, we are going to have that money back, because otherwise things are getting darker and darker for children.
And how can people support you and the work that you do in Gaza?
First, I think supporting GCMHP can happen in first people who can come to Gaza to deliver some training, some expertise, are more than welcome to come and join. Other things is that they can provide some support, donations that we could use to buy or to cover some salaries of the staff, or just to extend our services. And if anyone is interested, please go to the website of our twin U.S. organization, which is the Mental Health Gaza Mental Health Foundation, where you could make some donations. And each cent makes a difference in Gaza.
Absolutely, and just awareness. So again, informing and educating people on what mental health is in Gaza and how to help is crucial for the healing process. What sort of mental health education programs are there available for Gazans?
We have big campaigns. Part of our activities is to educate the people about the conditions, how to deal with the conditions, because we have more than 50% of the population in Gaza are children. We speak about 1 million children, and we speak about 1 million parents. So you need to tell those parents how they could better or best deal with the difficulties that children have. And the easiest way to do that, to reach this huge population, is through radio programs, through TV stations, through leaflets. We really print on an annual basis tens of thousands of leaflets on different topics that we send to the try to distribute as much as possible. We go to the communities, we do public meetings, we do workshops where we tell people how they could react, how they could deal with the difficulties, how they could help the children feel safety and security despite the difficult conditions. And this is a very important part of it. We try to work on primary prevention, which means that we try to make the parents engaged and helpful for the children before things get worse and worse, and those symptoms of traumatization could further develop into full-blown, let me say, disorder that needs more and more therapy and more intervention. So to intervene as early as possible is always needed.
It's really incredible and difficult work that you're doing there. And do you have any other messages for our listeners here in Portland as to what they should know and how they can maybe get involved in either finding out more or supporting?
Yeah, I think it's very important to for people to understand what's happening there. Please go and read about the conditions. Look what we Palestinians say about things. And also enjoy being free in a democratic country. So please go talk to your representatives, talk to your senators, and tell them to try to push as much as possible to, for example, revert the decision that was taken by the administrations, because this is good not only for Palestinians, but this is good for the whole region. And this is good also for the Israelis if peaceful means are coming, if justice is coming, if freedom to Palestinians is coming, because without the freedom of Palestinians, no one is going to be free.
Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, I mean, if you're dealing with the trauma of mental health, that's the condition, that's the symptom. The cause is the ongoing occupation and siege.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so in order to address the mental health issues, it seems that people would need to help to end the Israeli
yeah.
occupation.
Yeah. It's clear. We say in the blockade, in the occupation, do all the means to bring justice to Palestinian people. And these are things that the international community understands and should work on. It's not to let you know. No, you need to interact.
Yeah. And again, we've been speaking with Dr. Yasser Abu-Jameh, Executive Director of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program in Gaza. Their website, where you can also find out how to support, is gazamentalhealth.org. Dr. Yasser will be speaking at a congressional briefing on mental health in the Gaza Strip in the House Office Building in Washington, D.C. on Thursday, November 29th. And I know that your group and your supporters are asking people to contact their Congress members in order to urge them to attend that congressional briefing, in which you'll be describing the conditions in the Gaza Strip. So if people want more information about that or to contact your congressperson, just you can go to gazamentalhealth.org, find out the information, and then call your congressmember about that. Anything specific that you're asking people to do there?
Yeah, I think we need more pushing. We need more, efforts in order to move things in the right direction. And this is the very initial thing to do. You know, we need to move things around. And I think this will not happen without good efforts of American people who believe in justice, who believe in peace, and who believe in the safety and security of people who are just living in this world.
Mm-hmm. And are you encouraged at all by the election of the first Palestinian American Congress member?
Wow, yeah, this is, I mean, again, you are enjoying freedom. You are living in such a nice, atmosphere. Please make use of it and make people around the world make use of it. And I think you can make a difference. You can make a huge difference for a Palestinian child who is just 14, who saw 3 consecutive attacks, who never had the chance to leave Gaza, who sees the world through only Facebook and YouTube at the best.
Thank you.
Speechless, yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I know that you have to run to get on the road. We do have another guest, Jihad Abu Salim. We're going to go to a quick song, which is Israeli Geography 101 with David Robix. And then we're going to speak with Jihad Abu Salim with the American Friends Service Committee. And we will be taking your call, so stay tuned.
His eyes are filled with hate. He said the problem with those Arabs is they won't recognize a Jewish state. He said those Palestinians just won't come around to accepting Jewish rule on their holy ground. He said the Arabs
Arabs don't accept their new neighbors in the hood.
That's all we need to do.
Those ungrateful regimes don't respect us as they should. Well, I don't want to upset anyone or unduly take to task. But if a state wants recognition, it seems reasonable to ask. Where are your borders? Where are your borders? Where are your borders? Where are your borders? I heard him speaking to the Congress, getting his 29th standing O. He said, we need our security from those terrorists, don't you know? Well, if you want security, I wonder if you'd say it's true that the Palestinians should have security too. 'Cause if you want security, it seems only fair that you should also grant it to the people over there. And maybe you could answer, though the question is a sin, just where your country ends and your neighbor's lands begin.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland. That was David Rovick's Israeli Geography 101. You can call with your questions or comments. We're talking about the Gaza Strip this morning. The phone number here is 503-231-8187. And joining us now is Jihad Abu Salim, the Palestine-Israel Program Associate at the American Friends Service Committee in Chicago. Jihad, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we've been hearing this past hour about how life in the besieged Gaza Strip affects the mental health of its residents. Could you describe a little bit about what it was like for you growing up in the Gaza Strip, a place that has been called the world's largest open-air prison since the Israeli military controls the land, sea, and air?
It is indeed the world's largest open-air prison. My family was in the diaspora. They left the Gaza Strip right after the Israeli occupation of 1967. And my family only managed to get back to Gaza after the signing of the Oslo Agreement. And that was the first time for my dad to reunite with the rest of his family since he left in 73. And ever since growing up in Gaza, you as a child, as somebody who starts to understand and make sense of their space, of the place they live in, of the geography, of what does Gaza mean for me as a Palestinian. Ever since I was a child, I grew up to understand the complexities of living there, the hardships that come with the fact of being a Palestinian living in the Gaza Strip. Growing up in Gaza, my family owned a land next to an Israeli settlement that farther on. And we finished building our house, and we moved into that house just when the second Intifada started. So throughout the five long years of the second Intifada, we almost had no one quiet night where we enjoyed sleep in our new house that we built on our land because of the sounds of Israeli bulldozers and shooting and so on. And then I finished high school in 2007, around the time when two major Palestinian factions, Hamas and Fatah, were engaged in some sort of a civil war as a direct result of the inability of the international community to accept the result of the Palestinian Legislative Council / parliamentary elections of 2006. In which Hamas gained the majority of seats in the Palestinian parliament. And as a result of that, the situation in the Gaza Strip started to deteriorate, especially after international actors started to arm and support groups that were meant to hijack the democratic process and impose some sort of a rule in Gaza, despite the results of the democratic elections that were held. That was a very tough time. And then when I finished high school in 2007, I went to college, and that was the year in which the blockade on Gaza started in its brutal form that we know today. And ever since, you know, our life has become defined by how many hours of electricity a day we have access to. When will the water be available, and when will we ever get our portion so that we can shower once a week? I remember my teenage years in Gaza as years in which I was mainly concerned with like thinking about what to do in the 8 or 6 hours of electricity that I had access to. I remember, you know, going to college, and then in my second year, just witnessed the horrors of the so-called cast-lead operation. As a second-year student, I saw the first moments of that war. I witnessed to the moment when 150 Palestinians were killed in the first few minutes of that attack. And it's really hard to summarize what it means to grow up in Gaza, to live there for the entirety of your life, because the whole experience becomes in this whole experience, the rule becomes war, the rule becomes escalation, the rule becomes inability to access resources, inability to enjoy basic rights, and the exception becomes the opposite. Ability to travel, ability to enjoy 24 hours of electricity. I mean, my 17 years old sister, who 7 years old when the blockade started, she never experienced living in a world that has 24 hours of electricity. She just graduated high school with really excellent grades. And imagine, you know, for somebody who's 17 years old, she talks to me, and she's dreaming of, you know, hoping that she will ever get to the U.S. to study, to get into college. The luxuries, she's unable to imagine what it means to have access to 24 hours of electricity a day. This is how low the bar is for people in Gaza. This is what defines their daily experiences, just survival from 1 minute to another. So, I don't know, I hope I summed up the experience, but in all honesty, it's really hard to do that in a few minutes.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, life in the besieged Gaza Strip is something that is pretty unimaginable for a lot of Americans that really take electricity and our internet connection and our water flowing from our tap for granted. And since 2007, the siege, as you mentioned, has skyrocketed unemployment rates. Thousands of people have had their homes bombed and have been unable to rebuild because of the lack of building materials. Electricity's rationed, as you were talking about. And again, now people are protesting since March. I'm going to ask about that in just a moment, but we did have a call asking about the congressional briefing that we were talking about a little earlier with Dr. Yasser Abu-Jamay. This congressional briefing on mental health in the Gaza Strip is going to be on Thursday, November 29th, from 12 to 1 p.m. at the Rayburn House Office Building, room 2203. That's the Rayburn House Office Building in room 2203. Please tell your congressional representatives to attend and find out more. So you can talk to any Congress member and ask for them to attend or to send their staff to attend, but preferably the Congress members themselves, to hear from Dr. Yasser Abu-Jamay and to find out more about what's going on in the Gaza Strip, which is something that Congress is especially uneducated about. Jihad, can you tell us about the weekly protests since March? The Great March of Return has been going on in Gaza every week. Israel continues to attack the protests and shoot protesters with live ammunition with impunity. Over 200 people have been killed. Over 20,000 have been wounded, 4,000 of them with live ammunition. What is this Great March of Return, and why are people going to protest at the border?
This is really important. The Great March of Return is about two issues. One major long-term issue that is at the core of what defines the Palestinian predicament, and another is specific to Gaza. And I will start by talking about the first one, that is the idea of return being at the essence of this march means a lot of things and carries a lot of meanings. First of all, 70% of the people who live in the Gaza Strip, of the total population, are Palestinian refugees who were expelled from towns, villages, and cities that are just across the fence where these people protest on a daily basis. So when Palestinians in Gaza go to the fence to protest, it's a message to the world from these people, from Palestinians in Gaza. They say, look at the core of our tragedy. Our tragedy did not start in 1967, did not start in 2007, and did not start with the Oslo process or the First Intifada. Our tragedy as Palestinians started in 1948, when the State of Israel was established following a massive conquest of land and an expulsion of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their towns and villages. And these Palestinians ended up in refugee camps in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank, in Jordan, in Syria, in Lebanon, and elsewhere. And for these people, the inability of the international community to recognize that their plight is what's at the core of the entire Israel-Palestine question makes them feel that it was about time to not only talk about the right of return, but try to implement the right of return, try to go towards the direction of their towns and villages that from which they are separated by a fence. And that fence is a daily reminder for Palestinians in Gaza of what happened in 1948. It's a symbol. It's a reminder. It tells Palestinians every day that, look, you were forced away from your towns and villages. You were turned into refugees who were destined to live dependent on aid and charity and food packages. And you will stay there in order for us, Israel, to maintain a demographic Jewish majority in the state of Israel. This is very important to understand when it comes to why return is at the core of the march. The other issue is the issue of the blockade, which I just described. I mean, think about the people who are 20 or 21 or 19 years old who are protesting these days. These young people were just like 10 years old when the blockade started. The second decade of their life is what defines their childhood, their teenage years, is what, you know, instills the your perspective and perception of what's around you. And that decade, they only spent it under blockade. They only knew that there's no electricity and no fresh water, and they're not allowed to travel, and they're not, because the blockade was imposed as part of political blackmail by Israel and certain members of the international community who only want to deal with Palestinians the language of force and discipline and twisting our arms so that we can capitulate to the will of these states, even if the recipes for achieving justice are not right. I mean, they're still talking about the two-state solution and the two-state paradigm, but even the Israeli right itself that is in power recognizes that this is no longer a solution. But, you know, they have their framework, they have their think tank, they have the power that they can use through the media, through physical power to project this power on Palestinians in Gaza. But, you know, what happened was that Palestinians in Gaza did not surrender. They did not accept the reality in which their political will shall be defined by others projecting power on them. Because if humanity accepts that, then the world will turn into a jungle. So this is what the March of Return is about. It's a weekly protest in which grassroots organizers, civil society organizations, and people from all over the political spectrum in the Gaza Strip go to the fence. The fence for them is the Tahrir Square, where they can express their political demands, and they convey their message to the world that it's about time to address the real political questions behind what's happening in the Gaza Strip and in Palestine in general, and it's about time to end the unjust blockade.
All right. Just so you know, we have about 8 minutes left, and we are accepting your questions, so go ahead and give us a call at 503-231-8187. So just talking about the Great March of Return, in the U.S. media, we hear a lot about Hamas and how they are to blame for the current crisis. There are even claims that Hamas is hiding behind the civilian population, using them as human shields in order to carry out attacks against Israel. So as a person who grew up in Gaza, what is your response to these claims?
I mean, of course, Hamas is one of those buzzwords that are not mentioned in good faith to continue a conversation, but rather to shut it down. And but here is what I think. I grew up in Gaza, and Gaza is home to a wide spectrum of political forces, of activist groups, factional and independent, and it's also home to a civil society that has a long tradition of serving and Gaza and beyond, talking about their issues, and also championing issues of human rights and women rights, and you know, maintaining a progressive aspect to life in Gaza, sometimes even against the will of Hamas. So these people exist; they have their agency, and they are on the ground, and they understand that Hamas is in power. They understand that Hamas is basically the de facto government in Gaza. They understand that, but at the same time, they recognize that Hamas is also a component of that political spectrum. Hamas is a political party that includes, you know, people who form some sort of a social and incubator for the thought and ideology of Hamas, that is a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, and so on. So when the march was initially organized, almost people who represent all corners of that spectrum participated in the march, and you know, that included youth groups, women organizations, civil society organizations, secular forces, Palestinian leftist forces, and so on. So to say that this is the Great March of Return is just a puppet show that is being imposed by Hamas from behind the scenes really, really like does injustice to the agency of Palestinians on the ground who go on protests on a daily basis, who are not necessarily Hamas. I mean, we know these people. They're our neighbors.
Yeah.
Hamas, who participate and you know, conduct some sort of nonviolent protest. I mean, wasn't the international community saying, why wouldn't Hamas move from armed struggle to nonviolent? They should celebrate that Hamas is actually engaged in such form of nonviolent resistance.
And Jihad, your group, the American Friends Service Committee, has been a longtime advocate for peace from the Vietnam War until now. And among religious organizations in the U.S., they're leading the movement in this country for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Can you describe what this movement is, just briefly? We've only got a few minutes left, and how people can support it in order to challenge the injustice of what's happening in Gaza.
Yes, the BDS movement is called for Palestinian human rights, calls for ending the occupation of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, which is something that the international community agrees to, calls for the right of return of refugees, which is, you know, a right that is ensured by the United Nations General Assembly, so the international community agrees with that, and calls for equal rights for Palestinian citizens of Israel who live as second-class citizens. Also, another, you know, aspect of civil rights struggle that I don't think people in general would have a problem with. So this is what the BDS movement is about. It's a decentralized movement that calls for advocating for Palestinian human rights, for raising awareness and taking action and calling upon people to do the things that they can do in order to pressure Israel, in order to change U.S. policy on what's going on, and in order to hopefully, you know, shift the discourse and move things in a direction where Palestinian rights are recognized and are protected and hopefully are gained.
Thank you so much. And I'm sorry to cut you off. We're all out of time again. We've been speaking with Jihad Abu Salim, who is originally from Gaza. We've been speaking this past hour about the Gaza Strip, one of the two Palestinian-occupied territories in which Palestinian people live stateless under a foreign military occupation with no end in sight.
And for 51 years, Israel has denied Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory their basic civil, political, and human rights in defiance of international law. Palestinians don't control their own economy. They can't travel without Israeli permission, are denied access to religious sites, are restricted from accessing needed medical care, are denied educational opportunities, have their speech restricted, have their homes destroyed and their land confiscated, and can be arrested and detained indefinitely without charge or trial. And the list goes on and on. This is really the life under occupation, a reality that our guests today are trying to address and confront in their own ways.
And again, our guests this morning have been Dr. Yasser Abu Jameh, the executive director of the Gaza Mental Community Mental Health Program. And you've been hearing just now from Jihad Abu Salim with the American Friends Service Committee. Thank you so much for joining us in this special edition of Positively Revolting Talk Radio. Remember, KBOO is featured in this year's Give Guide. Support the station that you love with a tax-deductible contribution. Go to kboo.fm for more info.
Blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night. While the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. Through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go Gaza tonight.
Tonight.